Welcome to Yoga Talk, the Yoga International podcast. I'm your host, Kat Hegberg. I'm the editor of yogainternational.com. And I'm here today at the Sedona Yoga Festival in Sedona, Arizona. And I'm joined by Molly Burkholm, who I'm going to be talking with in a little bit. Molly was actually teaching this weekend at a training, a traumatic stress, resiliency and healing with yoga training. And we recorded that, or YA crew did. And so we are going to have that available for you to purchase on yogainternational.com really soon, probably around early summer, around June. So we'll give you more info about that coming up. But I want to talk to Molly today about her work as the co-founder and executive director of Warriors at Ease, which is an organization that builds yoga and meditation programs in military communities. Molly partners with the Department of Defense on PTSD treatment and prevention programs, and she also serves as the director of yoga programming and yoga therapy for the Shivananda Yoga Retreat, and is the director of human trafficking relief for the Integrative Restoration, or you might know it as IREST, Institute. I'm going to ask Molly a little bit later, too, about all of the really cool research that she's been doing with the National Institutes of Health, the Department of Defense, and Harvard University. But first, as we do here on Yoga Talk, Molly, first of all, welcome. I've been talking
Thank
a lot
you.
There. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thrilled to be here with you.
And first, I wanted to ask you about your yoga story. How did you get involved with practicing yoga? What drew your interest? And what brought you to where you are today?
My yoga journey began. I was actually an investment banker in New York City, and I almost died in a car accident. My cab driver was decapitated. I was trapped in the car with him for an hour. I had a lot of life-threatening injuries, fractured my spine, my sternum, and my skull. And in the recovery process, I was looking for what could help. I tried many, many, many different therapies, and both physical and mental. Finally, my mother said to me, you know, you should really take a yoga class. And in one second, it really just from the moment I stepped onto that mat, it felt like the right thing. And so I kept practicing and learning. And after a while, my more analytical left brain was thinking, why is this working? Why do I leave this hour and a half yoga class and feel better than I did before my accident? You know, what is it that's happening? At the time, that was in 2000, there was very little research out there aside from Dr. Herbert Benson and a couple of other little studies, but very, very little. So the spark was created there. And then I stayed in banking for many years after that, but I kept deepening the yoga practice. And then eventually I decided to leave. I took off for Asia. I lived for about 2 years in Asia, living in ashrams and a Buddhist monastery, and studying, you know, the ancient teachings, Vedanta, Sanskrit, and also different meditation styles at the Bihar school, and Buddhist meditation, Vipassana, and different things. So I started really trying to parse out what felt effective for trauma specifically. And the question kept coming up, okay, there's all these tools, but what actually works for trauma? Eventually, I returned to the U.S. and moved to Miami. Cousin worked at the Miami VA hospital as a doctor there and said, would you like to volunteer 1 hour a week to teach a wheelchair yoga class? I said, yes. And very, very quickly, the whole journey began in terms of offering this work to war veterans. Very soon, we were teaching in the PTSD department, substance abuse department, the three-month inpatient program, the lockdown psychiatric unit. And then research began, and the whole thing evolved. But really, I think it all goes back to that original trauma, that seed.
Wow, what a story. That's the work that evolved from that is just incredible. Thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask you specifically about teaching to populations who have experienced trauma and PTSD, because I know that's a topic that comes up a lot on the podcast, and what teachers can be, because I think something that came up a lot this weekend too is this idea that you're not just going to experience students with trauma who have experienced trauma in, you know, a class specifically for that. Like, all of us in our classes, like, we've all experienced trauma in some way, and how can we as teachers be more trauma-sensitive and aware in our teaching? What can we do, even if we're teaching, like, a weekly all-levels vinyasa class at the YMCA?
Great question. I think the first and most important thing to do when you know you have someone with trauma in your class is to realize the importance of a safe container, that trust is paramount, that those individuals know that you are going to be sensitive to their needs, that you are there for them to offer tools, that they don't have to do anything. And along with that sensitivity in that safe container comes an acknowledgement of that person, not as a broken individual who has a post-traumatic stress disorder, but in fact, looking at that person and at the whole class as whole beings who may have had traumatizing experiences, but people who, when paired with functional tools, can find that wholeness again. And I really feel like our belief and our recognition of that wholeness in other people can be the most tremendous liberation of all. So the creation of safety, trust, and also reframing the question of disorder as growth, post-traumatic growth. So we use these opportunities not as something that has to be fixed or changed. We embrace the trauma as an opportunity to dive into ourselves, to find wisdom, to find truth, to find healing, to find really our true nature, which is peace itself. And it's the same in everyone, no matter what we've been through, whether you're a death row inmate or the Dalai Lama or someone who's experienced the worst traumas, that wholeness, that stillness is the same in all. And it is, in fact, the practices of yoga that lead us to that direct experience of that stillness and wholeness.
That's so important for all yoga teachers, all humans to keep in mind this. But I think especially when we're offering something as a teacher, it can be easy to slip into the idea of, like, you know, even unconsciously, almost like a savior mindset, like, I'm going to help these people, I have all the answers. But, you know, we're just all people interacting with people. And I love what you said about that wholeness being there and that our students aren't people we need to fix. That's awesome.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to answer your question, but the principles, I think those two things, the creation of trust and seeing the people as whole, is really the most important thing you can do. In terms of the functional aspects of a class, there are many particular things that we can do to address trauma. And as you said, Kat, I work a lot with trauma, but I don't think I've ever taught a class that didn't have trauma in it. I mean, who hasn't had a traumatic experience at some point in their lifetime? So you can apply these principles to any class. The main point in working with trauma is the realization that after a trauma, our sympathetic nervous system gets locked into place. We are in fight or flight mode. We are in protective mode. We want to defend ourselves. It's that old primordial brain that is running from, you know, the saber-toothed tiger. And we have to make sure that ourselves and our families are safe. And so this protective tendency creates a nervous system that's totally tuned up. You know, trauma is categorized as a sensory processing disorder. So in someone with a quote-unquote normal, whatever that is, brain, that you could see a piece of trash in the road and say that's a piece of trash. But to someone with trauma from war, for instance, they might see it and think it's an IED, an explosive device in the road. So the senses are applying a different value on something that to someone who hadn't been to war wouldn't even perhaps notice the piece of trash in the road. And likewise with all different kinds of trauma, we all have different triggers. So when you approach a yoga class, you want to look at the fact that people are going to be more tuned up in that fight or flight mode. And you want to give practices that trigger what we call the relaxation response, which is essentially a triggering of the parasympathetic nervous system. And that cascades out and down through the body on a very biochemical level, how we're responding in our hormonal system, how our brain is responding. It's how, again, with the sensory processing, we're taking in inputs and creating an outcome. So basic things you can do in a yoga class, you can focus on deep tissue touch, things like hugging the knees and feeling that compression. Rocking motions, absolutely crucial. We rock babies. We stop rocking when we get older. In fact, there was a study done that showed even swinging on a swing for 20 minutes could provide a similar effect as an anti-anxiety medication. So integrating more rocking movements into our yoga practice can be very powerful. Doing things in a slow, deep, rhythmic way. So not rushing through the poses, but instead giving time to really melt deeply into them. Giving breaks between poses. The body takes those little, we can call them mini relaxations or mini shavasanas, as a chance to get back and feel equilibrium again. A chance to really tap back into that feeling of stillness and interweave a feeling of well-being throughout the practice. Likewise, different practices that cross the right-left brain barrier. So for instance, a simple twisting practice or an alternate nostril breathing, things like this that engage the right and left sides of the brain can help the brain learn to process better. So in terms of what we see with trauma, traumatized brain, amygdala grows, hippocampus shrinks, prefrontal cortex goes offline. When we can engage the right and left brains in certain ways through certain body movements, we're able to help stimulating certain parts of the brain in a different way. It's similar to, you know, walking, that right, left, right, left, right, left, or EMDR, where we engage the right and left brain. Yeah, I mean, I could go on for 3 hours like this, but there's...
we will link to the course. So, yeah. But yeah, no, it's fascinating. Yeah. I could let you.
But many, many factors. And the biggest factor just being that you're holding that calm, safe container and that you're welcoming of whatever happens for them.
Something that you said today in the training too that I really liked, was, I think it was today, the day is kind of, was the reminder that you don't have to be perfect either, that like we're all going to make mistakes, that we can come in with the best intentions and say something wrong, and just to, you know, be okay with that in a way and keep coming back and not let that discourage us.
Sure. You know, in general, if we can live our lives as compassionate, empathetic human beings and come from that place and to see the wholeness in someone, if I can see the wholeness over there and I can see the wholeness in here inside myself, there's nothing to fix or change. It's just pairing people with tools to find it. So if you can hold the container of kindness and empathy and also model the fact, hey, I'm not perfect. I'm doing the best I can and I'm doing it with an intention to offer you something meaningful. I've never had a vet get mad for me saying the wrong thing. And I've said the wrong thing so many times. So I'll just say thank you to all those vets for, you know, being kind and compassionate. And if someone does get upset, that's okay too. That's part of their process.
It's like that whole, and I always want to find the context for this quote, and I did once that I forgot, but the Maya Angelou quote, though, when you know better, you do better, and we just keep learning more and doing more. That's really encouraging.
Yeah, and when you can model that you cannot be perfect and that life still goes on, it's very liberating for people who feel damaged or imperfect. It's one of the most powerful things you can do, actually.
Even though I know we can't be perfect in our speech, are there any particular languaging things that we should keep in mind when working with or teaching yoga classes to people who we know have experienced trauma or PTSD?
Absolutely. You know, the first is just to look at what type of trauma they may have experienced and then bring a sensitivity to that. So if you're working with veterans, you're obviously not going to say something like corpse pose. You could change it to final relaxation. If you're working with human trafficking survivors who've been involved in the sex trade, you might not want to use a lot of terms around pelvis or things, you know, you're going to adapt your practice based upon what your audience is going to be able to receive in a supportive, nurturing way. But also really heavily in that is looking at the way in which we talk about our bodies and talk about our emotions and ourselves. So for instance, someone might say something like, I'm in pain, or my back is broken, or whatever phrase we may use, and then there's this I thought on that. There's a sense of ownership, like I myself, Molly Burkholm, am pain somehow, you know, or am a broken back. Instead, we can reframe it and phrase it: pain is present. Pain is present. And yet a lot of other things are also present. You know, every moment has thousands of sensorial experiences happening. When we are able to empower people with the view that pain may be present, and it may be present until the day they die, but something else is also present. And we're going to try to turn up the volume on that other. So creating that sense of awareness that pain is present, but something else is also present, that witnessing awareness, and then giving them tools to explore the pain. So teaching them to create space around it, teaching them to breathe into it, teaching them it's not a static, solid thing. It's actually very spacious. It's actually just a mass of sensation. So a lot of talk instead of, we never use goal-oriented language. I never say in the class, great job, Kat, because then it could imply at other points that you're not doing a great job,
right,
or that someone else is not doing a great job. So instead, it's all about being present with what is and really tuning into the sensation of what is there. And instead of having to attach to being the best or good or perfect or, you know, I don't know anyone who's reached enlightenment by touching their toes. It's just not the way it works, right? So if the focus can be on just being in the present moment, observing sensation, it's far more effective than the goal orientation.
Awesome. That's really, it's so much more empowering in a way to keep in mind too than kind of like just a list of like, make sure you say this and make sure you don't say this, but just again seems to go back to that overall big picture. It's awesome. So I wanted to ask you about the role of yoga nidra specifically, and maybe ask if you could talk to our listeners a little bit about eye rest and what that is and how it differs from the yoga nidra that we might be familiar with, like from Rod Stryker or Swami Rama or Swami Satyananda Saraswati, and what is that?
Sure, absolutely. So when we first started out looking at what was working for trauma and what wasn't at the VA hospital in Miami, initially my thought was that we should practice silent meditation, because that was what I practiced initially. And to tell you the truth, silent meditation in a person with severe trauma can actually be damaging. In a case of silence with someone who is in a very over-traumatized states, their brain will just go right back to the trauma. It also can happen that they start to disassociate. It's not to say that someone with trauma can't do silent meditation eventually, but at the initial first pass, what we've come to find is that they need a handhold through the body and through the mind. And that is one of the reasons why yoga nidra has really come up to the fore. And that is that it is that gentle handhold and guide through the experience of being human, really. So there are, as you mentioned, Kat, many forms of yoga nidra, traditional yoga nidra. Many of them are oriented towards a lot of visualizations, sliding down a rainbow, chakras, colors, bija mantras, and these are all beautiful practices. However, at places such as VA hospitals or other hospitals or in the military or even in many schools, you can't go in talking about chakras and bija mantras or else they'll kick you out the door pretty fast. So while our practice may have elements of that embedded in it, it is not necessarily accessible for a secular audience. In addition to that, many of the practitioners are not trauma sensitive. So on one of my favorite Bihar style CDs, they go through different imagery. They bring you into a calm, relaxed state, and then they suggest different images, the smell of a rose, you know, different things like that. And then all of a sudden you hear a dead body. So you can see where, and the idea behind it is that it comes into, we're learning to maintain peace amidst whatever is present. Much easier to have peace with a rose, much harder with a dead body. Well, for trauma populations, obviously we would never do that.
Right.
So Richard Miller, he's a clinical psychologist who developed yoga nidra. He very much knew the ancient practice of yoga nidra, but because he worked with more clinical audiences, he started seeing the need for a more trauma-sensitive practice. So he created the 10-step eye rest yoga nidra protocol, which starts with the creation of an inner resource, establishing the person in a place of safety. And then it guides them through the different koshas, the layers of consciousness, but it does so in a very secular, grounded, body, somatic experience way. So we don't go on journeys out of ourselves. We go on a journey inside of ourselves. We explore sensation. We explore emotions and how those emotions actually have an associated physical sensation in the body. We work with the notion of opposites and how being able to hold one thing and its opposite. You know, it's tension may be present, but somewhere else in the body feels very calm and spacious. Even in people who just had a limb amputated, they can find a place in their body that feels calm and spacious. So the more we can learn to explore all this within a safe context, which is essentially what yoga nidra does, and then throughout the whole thing develop that witnessing awareness where we're the observer of the experience. We're feeling it, we're still feeling it, but we're also learning that we are that witnessing state of awareness. We are that state of peace, having a very human experience, but yet also untouched by it.
I was, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, Molly, and I got to try an eye rest practice with Molly this weekend, and or this week, I think, again, weekend. It's a yoga festival. If you've ever been to one, you know the days kind of run into each other. But one thing that I noticed was a lot of times when I had done yoga nidra in the past, I had felt like if I had fallen asleep or dozed off or my mind had wandered, like I had failed at the yoga nidra. And I know, of course, that's not the point. You can't fail at a yoga nidra, but there's still that feeling like, oh, I didn't smell the rose. I didn't see the golden egg. I don't remember this guide. What happened? And so being able to do a practice that was just so focused on coming back to that inner resource, that safe place, feeling sensation in my body, I felt like I couldn't fail at it. Like I just kept being comforted again and again and being really present again and again. I realized that my right psoas was quite tight, which was kind of interesting. Yeah. But it was different than anything I'd ever done, and I really want to do it again. So if it sounds interesting to you, I highly recommend checking it out. And where can they learn more about eye rest yoga nidra?
So the website of the Integrative Restoration Institute is www.irest.us. My website is healingriveryoga.com. I teach about 4 eye rest trainings a year all over the country. I also teach in Europe each summer. And there are several different eye rest teachers, and all kind of have a different flavor that we bring to it. Certainly mine has a trauma sensitivity, whereas others are focused on different aspects, but the essential practice is the same. And I really appreciate what you shared, Kat, about that, because, it's a practice of welcoming. It's a practice of welcoming what's present in any moment. And that's it. And there's no wrong or right about what you're welcoming. It's just a practice of being present with what is. So, yeah, that's great.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm going to recommend it to all my friends.
Beautiful.
I have one final question for you, Molly. I wanted to ask you a little bit about yoga research. And you said something during the training, too, which I think I turned to, like, Kyle or Emily, and I was like, yes, because it was so great. Just this reminder about how we talk about yoga research. Because I know, like, as a yoga teacher, I'm really excited about yoga, and I want everybody to do it and learn it and find all of the great stuff that I've found from it. So it can be really easy to, go into class and say, well, studies show that yoga does this and this and this and this and this. But you were talking about how we have to be really careful about how we cite those studies and talk about those studies so that, and again, this is my interpretation, so you can correct me, but so that people continue to take us seriously. Because if I say, oh, yoga will cure this, or yoga's a magic You know, as soon as you say cure magic bullet or something, then nobody's going to take you seriously in science. And I think coming back to that science, we talk about that a lot on the podcast about integrating yoga and science. Mm. So I'd love if you could talk about that a little bit.
My pleasure. Yeah. Now, the past 10 years, we have had a tremendous influx of research on yoga and meditation, from neuroscience to genetic research to research on the different mental aspects, on pain, on insomnia, on depression, on anxiety. So there is a lot of really great science out there now. We don't have to make stuff up.
Yay.
So it's good news. And there are many wonderful benefits. You know, yoga historically has been viewed, and in many cases, I have to say, rightly so, as you know, this new age hippie thing that we're going to chant om and do all this, and we can do that all we want, and those are beautiful practices, not taking anything away from it, but if you're going to teach in a hospital setting, in an inpatient unit, in a public school where you might have Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and Jews all in one room, that's not going to be the language that speaks to everyone. And it's also not going to be the language that speaks to everyone if we start making unscientifically based claims. Mm-hmm. If you go into a hospital and you start claiming that shoulder stand is going to cure your thyroid problems, and you don't have a single research study in your back pocket to back that up, you probably will fairly promptly be given a talking to and possibly even fired. And it doesn't help yogis to do that. It doesn't help us. We need to elevate our game. We have the research now. We have the hard facts and science behind it. So let's use it. Let's lean into it. Let's keep creating more solid scientific research. So when we can go in and say, yoga and meditation elevate our GABA levels. That is a proven thing, that people with PTSD have lower GABA levels. So how great. Yes. You know, Herb Benson's work out of Harvard, the Benson Henry Institute, yoga and meditation are actually down-regulating stress genes. It is actually changing the expression of your genes. I mean, this is amazing. This is hard science. You cannot fake a genetic study, and there's no way around that. You know, the neuroscience, where we're seeing the shape of the brain changing in as little as 6 to 8 weeks, the gray matter of the brain changing, all from evoking the relaxation response. Wow. It's incredible. So we as yogis can feel empowered with these tools, and we can also likewise encourage our fellow yogis to stick with the hard science. And whether or not the yogis have known for thousands of years that shoulder stand helps the thyroid and parathyroid, that's another story. And it's great information. But if you're going into a more traditional environment, healthcare setting, stick with the science.
Yes. We actually have links to a lot of the studies that Molly just mentioned too in the show notes for, I forgot what number podcast it is, but I will link to it in these show notes, our yoga and science podcast. So you can read about the increased GABA levels and all of that amazing stuff that's happening and what research has shown. And I'm sure they can also find more of that information on your website as well, probably in far more detail.
Healing River Yoga, IRES, the Warrior Cities, we have more research than, if the yoga nidra doesn't put you to sleep, then maybe all the research will. We have tons of great studies up there. I'm just kidding. There's so much great stuff. So yeah, thousands of links. So.
Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon, Molly. Before we go, are there any current or upcoming projects, workshops, partnerships, anything that you'd like our listeners to know about?
Sure. We have coming up all sorts of things. We have a symposium on healing trauma at a Paradise Island at the Shivananda Yoga Retreat in the Bahamas. Oh, that sounds in April. So that's going to be great. And with Sat Bir Khalsa from Harvard as well, a leading researcher. And we have IRES training coming up in May in New York. We have a Warrior Cities trainings happening all the time, and many, many coming up, both the webinars and in person, and then several more Yoga Nidra courses in October and November. So yeah, almost constantly there's something fun, exciting happening. So yeah, it's many, there's such a beautiful invitation now from the world to keep sharing these experiences. So we need all of you to keep doing that too. We can't do it alone. So come join us. More opportunities all the time. And we hope to meet you soon.
Great.
Thank you, Kat.
Oh, thank you. And if you have any questions for me or anything about the podcast or show ideas, other people you'd like us to interview, then you can send those to yogatalk@yogainternational.com. And I will see you soon. Thank you again, Molly.
Thank you, Kat. You're awesome.
You too. The original score for this podcast is by Austin Joy.